ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Jack Myers, founder of MediaVillage.com, a community of advertising and media company sites and home to MediaBiz bloggers, Stuart Elliott Report, Planet Ed, Wall Street Speaks Out, Lunch at Michael's, and more. He is also the founder of The Future of Men, Masculinity in the 21st Century, is a recognized cultural visionary, award-winning documentary film producer, and advisor to hundreds of leading corporations on media and technology trends. Jack, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Let's begin with some background on your career. You have over 40 years of expertise in media, advertising, marketing.
You had to say that, didn't you?
All right, well, you started at the age of five. So can you give me the Cliff Notes version of your background and how it led you to found Media Village?
Sure, thanks. I started out in sales, media sales. I sold originally out-of-home media for a company called Metro Media, then moved into radio in the very early days of FM at WPLJ FM, the ABC station in New York, and then moved to CBS television. I had made somewhat of a name for myself in radio, selling to local retailers, and CBS was hiring for a local retail sales manager at Channel 2 in New York, moved into that role, and then over 7 years at CBS, moved in and developed a company-wide integrated marketing platform, one of the first successful ones in the industry, going after companies that were not using any of CBS's assets for their advertising, and had some success in that. Saw the emergence of cable in the early 1980s and was eager to move into that business, and spent 2 years with an emerging cable network that didn't make it off the ground, and then began consulting. Had many years as a consultant working initially with the cable industry. Then CBS actually brought me back in, and they continue to be a client of mine for many, many years. And the broadcast industry then began working with companies like General Motors, the Aegis Group as they launched Para in the United States, Coca-Cola, Sears, Campbell Soup, TJ Maxx, Turner, and most of the TV networks, really focused on the emergence of technology and how technology would impact on their businesses. So, of course, as the internet came along, that was a huge spur to my business. About 10 years ago, I really began to focus in moving away from consulting and figuring out where the needs were for the industry, and began focusing in on content marketing and thought leadership, recognizing that among 15 industries, media actually ranks last in use of content marketing and thought leadership as a B2B marketing tool. And in 2015, launched Media Village as the industry's home for thought leadership. We built a business model with no ad revenues, no subscriber revenues, no conference revenues, built on building out thought leadership platforms for what is now more than 60 companies, all living under the Media Village umbrella.
So that, you sort of glossed over it very quickly, but to have a revenue model that has no advertising dollars, no subscription dollars, and no conference dollars, so what are the magic beans? How do you make it work?
Well, that took 7 years to figure that out. So. And piece by piece to build it together, really by just sharing with the industry the goals of focusing in on both agencies, media companies, marketers, tech companies, really understanding their needs and objectives, and understanding that if we really wanted to focus on thought leadership, that it had to be an environment where there was journalistic integrity and not a question of pay for play, not a question of being dependent on driving traffic as a measure of performance, but rather on driving readership. And to drive readership, you had to minimize your page views so that people could be dependent that when they go to the site, they weren't going to have to click five times to read one article and have it cluttered with advertising. Being dependent on ad media companies, I hate to use the word clutter, but also wanting the content to be as exposed as possible and not requiring people to pay for it. So we really worked off of a traditional, more of a PR model of a monthly retainer, and providing services and KPIs against that retainer. And those KPIs are really focused in on having being able to demonstrate that we're positively impacting on their business and their incremental revenues. So we've put together a number of models where we can actually demonstrate success. We do a tremendous amount of research in the ad community on their perceptions, what they value, what their priorities are, and how they perceive the various sales organizations and the tools and resources they're being provided by the media sellers who work with them and serve them. And so we use that as a foundation to help guide our clients' strategies. And then from those strategies, we build content marketing programs and initiatives. We have 15 journalists on board, and then we own the distribution model through Media Village. So we're really controlling it from assessing the marketplace needs, the opportunities, the challenges, the obstacles to business growth. We then develop the initiatives programs, and then we actually implement and can control the implementation, and then we measure the success.
How does it work in terms of if it's not pay for play, but is it still sort of focused on these membership, these member companies, or is it broader that when their articles written that are underwritten, is it more like they underwrite studies, they underwrite articles? Can you explain that a little bit? I'm not sure I totally am following how it works.
Sure. Well, first of all, we put every piece of content we publish through two layers of journalistic review to confirm that it's providing actual thought leadership, actual knowledge to the industry. Cannot be blatantly self-promotional, although obviously it can speak to the tools, resources, innovation, services they provide. Everything is published on behalf of companies, organizations, or thought leaders at their dedicated content site that's transparent, that it's their published content.
I see. Okay, that makes sense. So when you're creating this filter of what determines if something is genuine thought leadership, is there a checklist that you employ? Like if somebody is sitting at a media company now and thinking, I really should build my profile as a thought leader, what are the things that they should be thinking about and looking at and being curious around?
It's a really great question. I can tell you where our content is primarily focused and where our members are dedicating the most content. And we've identified 11 areas that are priority categories for content. Five of those categories are basically maintaining the status quo, communicating that they're putting up the table stakes. And those are a brand trust, that they're a trusted organization, a brand safe environment, their reach, the audience they're reaching, and that they're reaching meaningful numbers, the quality of their demographics and their value proposition, and relevant targeted audiences that they're reaching. So those are the table stakes, basically. Where they can really impact on their business is on advanced technology and advanced data and analytics, an effective sales organization, and that's typically executive profiles at all levels, not just executives, but we have platforms like Women Advancing where we focus on female executives. We have First Five that focuses on young team members in the first 5 years of their careers, legends and leaders, and Advancing Diversity to focus on their diversity initiatives and inclusion initiatives. And then moving on, the last three, enhanced marketing services, investments in original content, and most importantly, vision and leadership. We're finding that there is an extraordinary lack of vision and leadership being communicated by our industry.
Yeah, that's really funny. Yeah, I would have to agree, but it's, gosh, you kind of think that's where you would go first. I think there's a lot of fear that's behind probably.
there's statistical evidence to that comment too, which is really frustrating and really launched me in the move toward building Media Village. And that's, as I said earlier, media industry ranks last on thought leadership and content marketing. The most successful B2B marketers invest an average of 40% of their B2B marketing budget on content marketing and thought leadership. The average, industry average for the 15 leading industries is 28% of their B2B marketing. Our industry, media and advertising, invests 2 to 8% on average of their into thought leadership and content marketing. The amazing thing is that as I've been out sharing statistics with several of our companies in the industry, they say, well, that assumes you have a B2B marketing budget to begin with.
Oh, gosh. Right. So where do you start? Where do you even start there? Goodness.
They're budgets that have been cut away to the core as media companies are being forced to, especially the media sales components of their businesses, are being forced to scale back budgets. What's being cut back are the areas that are most important to generating incremental growth. And that's frustrating for them. But I also think it's an opportunity for us to really have a very cost-efficient model that they can do have content marketing on a turnkey basis.
What's interesting, though, is it sort of goes hand in glove for why there's a dearth of a vision and leadership. Because if you can't see the importance and you can't see how this can help your business and how it's actually very critical to reaching and pushing forward in the new mm-hmm. landscape, you know, where do you start? I was interested, there was a quote in one of your articles, and I'm going to read it. And I think it was, while brand safety and trust have been elevated to the forefront of the upfront sales messages, these issues are simply table stakes and are having mm-hmm. limited impact on ad spending decisions. What I thought was so interesting about reading that quote was just Friday, a few weeks ago, I was at the Variety Entertainment and Tech Summit, and every single panel talked about brand safety and trust. And I was listening thinking, well, isn't this stuff, you know, this is necessary but not sufficient to move things forward. Why do you think that that is where the conversation has stalled out, though?
Well, yeah, brand safety is the hot buzzword of the moment because of some of the realities that are happening in society and culture that are driving it. Brand safety has always been an issue. The networks have always worked with the agencies to manage where advertiser messages run and to take care over that. A lot of the realities on the digital side extend beyond just safety to fraud and bots and other issues. So it's really, it's bubbled up kind of from the primordial mass of the underbelly of our industry that this is a concern. It's always been a concern, and there have always been easy solutions. There are no easy solutions, but everyone feels that if they put it to the forefront and identify themselves as being a brand safe environment, it'll position them. Well, the reality is that Facebook, with all the challenges they've had, about 0.3% of their total business is in jeopardy because of a brand safety issue. And while they're being responsive from an economic point of view, Wall Street is not not punishing them for that potential loss, even though it's 0.3% of it is a lot of money. It's not a business changer. And advertisers, marketers only hear the negative when everyone's talking about brand safety. All the marketers here, the brand people, the CMOs who spend a limited amount of their time on advertising and media hear, uh-oh, there's a problem. So when everyone's talking about where the solution, all they're hearing is, wow, there's a big problem. And they're not saying we're going to make our decisions based on who says they're brand safe. We're going to let the agency do that. Of course, we don't necessarily trust our agency, but that's going to be their job. So it becomes the agency's job. And the agencies are saying, we've always done that. And we are continuing to do that. And we're not going to, you know, radically alter our business placement decisions on brand safety. It's table stakes. We expect you to be safe. And we're only going to do business if you're a safe environment for us. And if we find out you're not, we're going to pull our business. But it's not moving money from one place to another.
Right, right. Now, shifting a little bit, you have a report tomorrow, today. What are some of the most profound insights that you've shared on that. What do you think is something that if people aren't familiar with the material that they should be aware of?
Thank you for the question. I would say there that at the top of the list is that marketing over the last 20 years has generated only 0.5% annual growth. Marketing is essentially a flat business. And if you factor in inflation, it's been down 15 to 20% in terms of total marketing spend above and below the line. Almost 100%, if not more, actually, of the growth of advertising over that time has been monies moving from below the line promotion, PR, and other below the line categories to above the line media. And almost all of that is going to digital. A second economic finding that we've reported is that in 2016, of all the digital video dollars invested by advertising and media, all the digital video dollars invested, 45% went to legacy media companies, the TV networks, magazine, newspaper, and other legacy media companies. In 2018, only 30% of digital video dollars are going to legacy media. And by 2022, only 20% or less of digital video spend will be going to the legacy media companies. And that's YouTube, Amazon especially, and other digitally based companies, including Netflix, begin to accept and grow their advertising base. So the TV networks percentage or share of the video dollars coming into digital are shrinking, and that we're projecting starting in 2020, 2021, 22, that the legacy TV networks have the potential of seeing a newspaper-like decline over the next decade as advertisers look at the ability to achieve goals more effectively in non-linear media. And TV networks, I believe, are only scratching the surface of the solutions they need to implement in order to reverse that trend. Although they've been better than print has been, and certainly better than the music industry has been, there are perils, the old-fashioned internet superhighway.
Right. Well, it's so funny. You went right into it and I had these notes. My next question was around exactly these quotes of some of these numbers. Where do you source your data? Is this original survey work or is it a combination of publicly available information? Where are you sourcing the data that underpins these findings?
Yeah, I've been publishing and developing original economic forecasts for more than 30 years. We were rated a few years ago by a Goldman Sachs media analysis as the most accurate forecaster. Media spend, we're the only forecaster that does both above and below the line, historic as well as future projections and data. And we break out all media by their legacy or linear spend and their digital spend. So a lot of it is original data that we gather through both public sources, trade associations, organizations, all the agencies, all the analysts, but also through in-depth analysis of data published by the media companies, as well as interviews that we conduct in the industry.
So I'm curious just to make sure I understand the numbers. When we're talking about the sort of scary 2020, 2021, 2022 landscape and legacy networks having less of the spend, is that within their linear business or
their overall advertising business? And I've been meeting with executives from the networks, from marketers, from agencies, and I really haven't gotten any pushback on our data. There seems to be consensus around the threat to advertising. And you see that with CBS, where only 46% of their revenues today are advertising revenues. You see it at Disney and ABC as they look more at their IP, the value of their IP as the future focus that they present to Wall Street. And you also see it in the increasing commoditization of the business through the development of automated platforms, machine learning, and the inevitable focus on greater cost efficiency that drives.
Right, right. What do you think could you know, you said that you haven't seen, you know, obviously what's interesting is the networks are aware of this. You've spoken to them, they're not pushing back. Goldman has said, yeah, you're the best at analyzing this stuff. And you're saying they're heading towards a cliff. What would you expect to start seeing them do that they're not doing?
Well, first of all, one of our projections is that by 2025, about 95% of all media transactions will be managed through machine learning, machine intelligence. And we're on that track. Also, 80% will be automated. And by automated, I also, by inference, means that there'll be smaller and smaller segments of highly premium content within the audience, within the automated segment. That leaves 20 to 30% of media inventory across all media that will not be commoditized and will be focused on the brand association with the content, with the IP, the advertiser's ability to build their own brands through association with the IP or the brand equity of the media content. Sports is the best example of that today. Sports, the Academy Awards, some of the live programming opportunities, the big platforms, but where there are also offline merchandising opportunities, some of the syndicated programs like Ellen and Oprah and others where there's strong brand equity. And the media companies, I believe, need to be focusing in more clearly on what percentage of their revenue base in the future do they see being focused on the brand equity of their content and IP versus the equity around the number of impressions they can generate and among the which audiences they're generating those impressions. So a traditional CPM-based model versus a more traditional sponsorship brand association model. And I believe that we need to look at sales organizations and recognize that they need to be bifurcated and focused more heavily on automation for that inventory that's going to be under the machine learning and automated data model, and developing sales organizations that can really support the brand equity of the content. And that means it goes beyond advertising. It goes into those below the line budgets to tap into sales promotion, direct marketing, commerce, based promotions, things that where there's merchandising opportunities. They also have to be focusing more aggressively on the realities of mobile, and that more and more video content will be watched in some form of streaming and mobile content. So you're seeing companies making those transitions and that transformation. But for the most part, you know, 95% plus of all media is sold in a very traditional model. And I believe that we need to see those models broken and in many ways rebuilt from the ground up.
Mm. Do you think that there is an organizational resistance to it based on people who maybe they have 5 to 8 years before they're going to retire? They've got their incentives. They understand that they're just trying to push it out to stay with it. Is there an organizational component that's making it difficult for them to implement some of these changes? Or do you just think that they're not believing these are the changes that need to be made?
Yes. The answer is yes. There is an organizational resistance. I would say no, that I believe most people understand that these changes need to be made. But I would say the greatest force for resistance is Wall Street. Wall Street simply does not allow legacy media companies to make the kinds of investments and transformation they have to make, which mean biting the bullet and showing declining short-term revenues in order to build a better long-term business. And as long as Wall Street is dictating the decisions that companies are making, and primarily the legacy companies are making, because they do give those that leeway to the digitally grounded companies, we're going to continue to see a slow adoption and piece by piece, and it not being substantive enough until it's so clear to Wall Street that that's what's necessary, that they begin rewarding. And we saw that in the newspaper industry. They didn't reward the newspaper companies for change until it was too late.
Right. Well, you'd think, having gone through that with newspapers, that they would, or they might be inclined to. I mean, why is Wall Street so much easier on some of the digital players? Why are they easier on Netflix?
Well, I wish I had a great answer to that question.
I know, I really is. If you did, you would need to, you know, work anymore, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'd be on Wall Street.
I mean, it seems like they need to have the sort of, they need to be enlightened a bit. What is it?
It really comes back to the comment on visionary leadership. And the visionary leaders have to, in our industry, have to operate almost quietly and behind the scenes and then make big moves, like, you know, Disney, like Fox being for play. So Rupert Murdoch breaking up his companies and putting it into play. And then Disney and Comcast, you know, kind of divvying up the spoils. So those big moves that signal certain focus, but Comcast and Disney have very different vision in terms of why those assets are valuable to them. And they're not really effective in communicating that vision in a way that is meaningful to Wall Street, because when they do, Wall Street doesn't reward them for it or doesn't understand the vision or, you know, doesn't even want to look 5-10 years away. They want to look into the next quarter and maybe the next year. And the types of decisions that these companies are making have to have a 10-year vision. And I believe the TV industry and the media industry as a whole has just entered about a decade-long period of radical metamorphosis. You know, there'll be husks left on the ground and where you don't know what the butterfly will look like, where it'll land, or whether it'll be beautiful or not.
What do you believe is behind Comcast's interest in Sky? Do you think this is just to make things difficult for Disney, or do you think they're using it as a way to grow their global network? What do you think is behind their interest in Sky?
Well, I really don't think it's to complicate things for Disney. I think it's to jump in on and disrupt the overall shift of assets from Fox to Disney. But I do think Comcast is primarily a distribution company and is looking for broader distribution. And whereas Disney, I believe, is primarily an IP-based company, a content-based company, and focused on IP. So you have two very different long-term strategies in play, and where Fox can, Sky is certainly a critical player on the distribution side, but also in terms of the value for distribution of IP, it's a valuable player.
Right. Pulling ourselves, our conversation back to Media Village and the business model that you've struck, do you think that that business model is something that other companies could leverage the thinking behind, or is it really so nuanced and specific to B2B situation? I mean, is there something about your structure that could be leveraged across?
Absolutely. Yes, there's no question but that I've spent 35 years building the brand, the credibility, and the assets to be able to have successfully launched Media Village, a long history of content creation that's valued and a brand that's recognized for being a thought leader in the industry, the research and economic reporting that we've done for decades. But the real secret sauce is the launch of a platform that's dedicated to thought leadership and where companies can be comfortable housing their thought leadership, knowing that they have a dedicated home for it, there are credible journalists helping create the content, where their voice can be communicated without a competitive voice being interjected, without competitors' advertising sitting within it, and also where they can be confident that it's surrounded by credible, authentic journalistic content. That model can really be replicated. While it's not my personal goal, it's certainly a company goal to expand Media Village internationally. And also, we believe that there should be we have a platform called TV Video Download, that focuses on programming with a heavy emphasis on studio-created content. And we believe there's an opportunity for Hollywood Village, but there's also an opportunity for Pharma Village, for Automotive Village, for the Wall Street Village.
Brand marketers could really look at this model and within their own industry and take it and understand that this could be an opportunity for them as well.
Exactly. And within Media Village, we have CMO Village, we have Creativity Village, we have Ad Tech Village. So we have, even within Media Village, done brand extensions that are part of our long-term business model.
Fantastic. Fantastic. We've actually run longer than I said we would. So it's crazy. Mm-hmm. And we haven't gotten to touch on your book, The Future of Men, Masculinity in the 21st Century. And I have to say that as the mother of two boys, it really resonates with me. Your TED Talk, was yelling at
you,
saying, yes, exactly this. So
how old are your boys?
17 and 14.
Right. Your 17-year-old especially is right in the sweet spot of the generation I'm talking about, who are often feeling left out, and the concerns that we've created a lean out generation of young men, even as we've created an extraordinary lean in generation of young women.
Well, it's very interesting, as being a feminist, raising feminist boys, and yet then going to bat with the administrators of their school saying, we need to do better for our boys, that, you know, they need to have voice and we need to not pathologize boy behavior.
Especially with the reality that every day there's a new story of male misbehavior and inappropriate behavior, which I think is, not even being strong enough about how inappropriate the behavior is. But the first chapter of the book really calls out that behavior and predicts the Me Too movement. And it was published 2 years ago. But my concern, and the concern that I reinforced throughout the book, is that as we've developed a generation of young men who are feminists, who believe in pay equality, who don't see cultural differences or gender differences, and then as they enter their adult years, they come face to face with bias that is negatively, that is required, is important, is essential for the culture, society, and business to advance inclusion and diversity. But this generation is paying the price for decades, if not centuries, of male dominance. And while it's critical that they understand that this is something they're going to be dealing with throughout their lives, that they don't turn against women as a result of it, but find their own path and their own identities and their own opportunities, and that society supports and encourages those opportunities.
It's a absolutely spot on, I believe, way to look at things. Although I think that given the Me Too movement, it is a challenging needle to thread. And have you found it? How has the reception been? Are people receptive? Are they listening to the nuance of your conversation?
Well, there are a lot of responses. Invariably, when I'm introduced as having written a book about the future of men, I'll get responses from women saying, I'm much more interested in the future of women. So I try to explain that so am I, and that's why I've written a book about the future of men. But when I was writing the book and I'd mention to men that I was writing a book about the future of men, I would get back the glib comment 70% of the time, you mean we have a future? Well, I don't hear that anymore, because men are taking very seriously the question of their future. It's not a joke. But I am finding that young men especially are much more engaged. My best, most valuable response, my most consistent positive response has come from the women's movement. The invitation to speak at TED Women, at the 3% conference, at Shelley's Alice's Equality Lounge, Girls Lounge events. The industry's been very, the women's rights movement has been very supportive. The angry men's movement has been on the attack since my book came out. If you read the reviews at Amazon, there are some from men that are, I'm feminizing women, and my response is, absolutely, that's exactly what I'm doing, and we need more of it, in the same way that, women have learned to adopt some of the most positive traditionally male characteristics, and that's behind, you know, their success, the ability to combine the best qualities, gender unrelated to gender and the traditional norms that we look at. So it's a very fine line to walk, and especially one where I have to be cautious because I do have a business to run, and you know, I don't want my voice to be overly focused on what are my passion and purpose interests.
Right. Well, thank you so much for sharing. And finally, where can our listeners find you and where can they learn more about you and your work?
Thank you. MediaVillage.com, of course, JackMyers.com, and FutureOfMen.com.
Wonderful. And Myers is spelled M-Y-E-R-S. Just wanted to point that out to people
you.
Who are listening.
Thank you. Like Fort Myers. Myers rum, yeah.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, Jack Myers. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.